What's going on, everyone? Welcome back to Netting Narratives. Thank you for tuning in. I know it's been a while. This episode was actually recorded in 2023. So I interviewed Professor Senecal about a bunch of different things. I mean, he's a great guy. You can really talk to him about anything. He's a psychologist and a professor at Assumption University. So enjoy the episode. I think we even talked about like shrooms at one point. This was really cool. This guy's a G. Enjoy. Okay. Peace.
So first, thank you, Professor Senecal, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah,
I was under the impression that you taught psychology, which you do. That's right?
Yeah. I'm a psychologist.
Okay.
And I've primarily taught psychology, the majority of my academic career. But in 2019, I was hired by the Human Services Department here at Assumption. Now, Human Services is a multidisciplinary field of which, psychologists will work in, clinical counselors, et cetera. So it's not like a total square peg in a round hole type of deal. But it was a different job in a different department with different material, different classes. So, yeah, it was definitely, especially the first year or two, it was definitely an adjustment to teaching some of those new classes.
Okay, and you just mentioned that you taught one semester, I don't know if it was for more than one semester, but you taught eight classes at three or four different institutions?
Yeah, so in 2014, in the spring of 2014, I defended my dissertation proposal at West Georgia.
Okay.
What that means is once you defend your proposal and you finish all of your courses, you're something called ABD, which is all but dissertation. So you finished your PhD. You just need to write your dissertation and complete
it. Okay, wow.
So I was ABD in the spring of 2014, or summer of 2014, I was ABD. My wife was pregnant with our first kid at that time, and I had gotten approval from my dissertation chair to write my dissertation remotely, which meant I didn't have to stay on campus to do the work as long as I was checking in with her. This is Dr. Lisa Osbeck at West Georgia, a brilliant, brilliant general psychologist, history of psychology. So Lisa had given me permission to basically write the dissertation from wherever I wanted. So Megan and I were like, we're both from this area. Megan was pregnant. We were like, well, let's go home. Mm-hmm. Let's go home. Right, but coming home, I had to, Meg was super pregnant. She was due in September. And I was like, all right, well, I think I can get adjunct work and I can like piece it together. And so I just started sending my resume probably in like April of 2014. I started sending my resume to like...
For the hopes of fall 2020.
For the hopes of fall 2014. Right, yeah. I started sending my resume to like every department chair, every psychology department chair in like the Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Southern New Hampshire area. And... actually, like, in a really neat way, Assumption's department chair was the first one to reach back out to me. It was Paula Fitzpatrick. So Paula was the first person to hire me as a psychologist.
Wow.
Yeah, outside of grad school, it was for two classes, two sections of general psychology, which is our psych department's intro to psychology. It was like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, back-to-back classes, 12:30 and 1:30 in the Kennedy Lecture Hall.
Let's go.
And I was like, and at that point I was like, you know what? I've got two of these. I was like, let's go home because I think I can get more. Mm. But like that job alone gave me like all the motivation to try to get more. So then Framingham State had a slot open. They hired me for one section of intro to psych.
Okay.
Anna Maria. And then I also had a master's degree in philosophy at that time.
Awesome.
But I had been adjuncting as a philosopher at Mass Bay Community College, QuinSig, Middlesex Community College before I left to get my PhD in psychology.
Okay.
So I reached back out to those department chairs at the community colleges as well to be like, I can teach psych or philosophy, whatever you have openings for. And so Anna Maria hired me to teach philosophy. It was an ethics course.
Okay.
And then Mass Bay hired me to teach two sections of intro. It was called Problems in Philosophy. It was their intro class. So I was basically teaching intro to psych or like intro to philosophy at it was three sections of Intro to Philosophy and five sections of Intro to Psych. And then at the end of that summer, it was like July. It was like July of 2014. I had all those classes lined up, and then in July, and I had back in the spring, I had met Mark Freeman, who was the department chair at Holy Cross's psych department, at a conference. Okay. He had sat in, again, like serendipitously, he had sat in on a talk that someone else was giving, but I happened to be giving my talk. I don't think he was there for me. He was there for somebody else. But
worked out.
But then we met, and he was like, "Oh, you're from Worcester?" I was like, yeah. I was like, I'm going back to Worcester. He's like, "Well, hey, keep in touch. And then someone from Holy Cross's psych department got sick before the semester started. They took medical leave. So they needed classes covered too.
This guy just remembered you, or is he just
he reached out. Reached out in July, and it was just so fortunate. So that first year, I was teaching eight classes a semester at five different colleges. In the spring, it was four because I left Anna Maria after the fall because I didn't need it. You know, it was too much. So I picked up another class at Framingham. So I was like, all right, I'm good. I can keep it.
Were you able to know the students' names? How are you doing this grading? How many classes do you teach now a semester?
Three or four.
Right.
Yeah.
As a,
yeah.
As so it's full time.
As full time. Yeah. So I mean, it's half the load. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I knew students' names. I always take attendance. I've always taken attendance. It's how I always teach.
Sure.
And I learn students' names by taking attendance. So usually by midterm, I know all my students.
That's great. And as far as you said you got a master's in philosophy. Mm-hmm. Where was that from?
University of Leuven, Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium.
Well, in Belgium. And why'd you do that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So when I was an undergrad, I was something called a great books major.
Okay.
Which
the cortex almost?
Yeah, okay. Kind of. Yeah. It was under the philosophy department at St. Anselm. It was like a sub major of the philosophy department. Or like it was a major within the philosophy department at St. A's.
Of course.
And I remember when I was at St. A's, we had to take 2 years, so four semesters of this class called Humanities, which was basically the study of Western Civ, over four semesters. We started with Plato and Aristotle, and we ended 2 years later talking about jazz music.
Wow.
And Duke Ellington. We covered a ton of breadth, a ton of depth,
of course,
and a ton of different ideas in that time. And it were all seminar classes. So you just sat in a room with your professor and you talked with students, and man, I was just bit by the bug. So I remember going to my advisor at the time and saying, how do I major in this? Can I major in this? And he was like, well, the closest thing is probably great books. And I was like, cool, let's do it. So my sophomore year, I took a great books course. I took Renaissance great books my sophomore year. So we were reading, Shakespeare and Don Quixote. You know what I mean? Like a ton of interesting stuff. And I was like, yeah, I want to major in this. So so under great books, you take your six great books courses, and then you take a couple philosophy, a couple English, a couple art classes, and that's your major.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and then I did a few independent studies in philosophy. I did an independent study on Dostoevsky, who's a Russian novelist and existential philosopher.
Right. What's his famous book that I have not read? Is it Crime and Punishment?
So Crime and Punishment's probably the most famous.
Okay, right.
I think Brothers Karamazov is probably the most important.
Okay, cool.
But it's really long, and Crime and Punishment's like 500 pages, but Brothers K is like 850 pages, and it's like 17 different characters, and you got to learn all these different Russian names and stuff. Yeah, it's a monster read.
Yeah,
but I remember this was my junior, I also did an independent study on Foucault my senior year with another Professor Ed McGushin. So Professor Dave Bannock and Professor Ed McGushin, and they were just huge, huge influences on me. And they both really pushed me. They both really pushed me to go to graduate school in philosophy. They were like, hey, you can do it. Give it a shot. And I was
amazing.
Like, okay. I was like, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I wanted to do what they were doing.
Right,
I love those people. I thought they were brilliant, and I wanted a life like they had, teaching.
Sure.
And being involved in these ideas. And so then I was looking at schools, and Professor Dan Murphy, who I'd had for one class, I forget which class it was. It might have been Modern Philosophy. I think it was Modern Philosophy. I had Dan for that class, and Dan had graduated from this place called Leuven, you know, and we were all like, you know, everybody was like, you know, everybody knew what BC was, or right, Catholic, you know what I mean? And it was like, you know, Duquesne, everybody was like, what the hell is the Ven?
Yeah.
And he was like, well, it's like one of the greatest, he's like, it's one of the best continental philosophy schools in the world.
That's why
you
don't know about it. But
yeah, yeah. You know, but it's over in Belgium. It's an international program. You know, you don't have to speak Dutch, you know, to take it. It's an English speak, you know, all the professors teach the classes in English and stuff. And so I had applied to like BC, I applied to BC and Leuven, excuse me. And, I got into both, and honestly, it was just the price. Like, BC was like $45,000 a year, you know, to go. It was going to be like $90,000 to get my master's in philosophy, which is like a PhD in philosophy could get you a job, but a master's in philosophy doesn't get you any job.
Interesting.
In Leuven, the tuition was like, no, I'm not joking. It was like 500 euro.
Oh my god.
It was like 500 euro. Yeah. It was like $750. So now I had to pay to fly over there.
Yeah.
I had to get an apartment, you know, in Leuven.
Sure.
You know, I had to buy food, but like tuition was $700. And I was a little bit of like an adventurer anyway. You know what I'm saying?
I can tell that. That's my next question. Like,
yeah,
I'm majoring in philosophy, and that's because I came to this school, mm-hmm. which has a mission that's kind of geared toward the liberal arts, right? Mm-hmm. And you were on a panel earlier this year in the summer, actually, mm-hmm. to talk about the importance of liberal arts, right? And
yeah.
Was St. A's a liberal arts school? Or
yeah, St. A's is, I mean, it's as close to a sister school of Assumption as you can get. Yeah, yeah, I mean, St. A's is, you know, St. A's is, you know, I don't want to say it's like a cookie cutter copy of Assumption, but it's a pretty similar college, college about 90 minutes north of here.
But you could have chose something else that was, you know, guaranteed a job right after college where you could just work and make money. So what was the biggest driving force in you making those decisions you made in college? Was it your parents or people around you?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a hard one too. That's a good question. My parents did a good job. Did a really good job. You know, my parents never went to college. You know, my father graduated from high school. He did a semester of college, and then he joined the Navy. And then he worked, you know, after that. He had epilepsy, and he was discharged from the Navy after about 2 years of active duty. You know, he'd had seizures on a boat. So he was given a medical discharge from the Navy when he was 20, you know, maybe 21. Wow. Yeah. Wow. And he had just worked. You know, my dad was a truck driver when I was a kid. You know, he's now a process engineer without a degree or anything. Like, he's a really smart guy who's, like, worked his way up into the field. Yeah. Right. But my dad was driving. When I was a kid, my dad drove a truck, like, and delivered food, you know, to stores. My mother dropped out of high school when she was 15. Her father was an alcoholic. Yep. He had gotten fired from work for showing up drunk to work.
Oh, wow.
My mother was struggling in school, not academically, but socially. And at 15, she just said, I'm just going to go work. And her and her sister, my Aunt Debbie, they started working at a factory called American Optical that was down the street from their house in Southbridge. They grew up in Southbridge, Massachusetts. They started working at the AO when they were 15 and 17, respectively.
Wow.
And I mean, so my parents never went to college, but they always wanted my sister and I to go to college, and they never really put their hands on it. You know what I'm saying? They were just kind of happy that we were there. They were happy that we had these things that we were into. You know,
they also allowed you to make the decisions.
Yeah, yeah, they were great. They did a great job at being like non-directive with us, which I really, really, really hope I can do with my kids. You know, sure. You know, you always say that, you know, every parent you talk to is like, well, I just want them to do what makes them happy. It's like,
see, that's not an easy question to answer.
Right? I think a lot of parents have ideas of what they think would make their kids happy. Sure, right, you know what I mean? And we can
agree on that, but how are we going to get there? Because
yeah.
A lot of parents then I think would resort to just giving them then what they want, as if what they want is the answer to giving them happiness.
Fair enough. Like, there's that. But there's also the other side of parenting, which is like, I'm going to give you what I want.
Right.
And that's the thing that I'm a little bit more that's the thing that I get a little bit more concerned about with parenting, mm-hmm. is like parents living subconsciously, vicariously through their kids,
right.
You know, and I think a lot of parents can project their own regrets and failings of their own life onto their children, and then hope that their children can kind of almost in a way, you know, like, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this, like, parents can kind of like resurrect the failings, you know what I mean? Or like right the wrongs of their own lives. No, I see what you mean. That's through their kids. And,
You know. That seems like a greater concern, because it actually is, it's more reasonable, right? It's like, you're a parent, you have more experience, you kind of understand the world better than the kids, so you want to help them. It's like,
sure,
it's very different from what I said, where parents giving their children what they want.
Yeah, right? Snow plowing for them and clearing all the obstacles. Yeah, I mean, that's problematic.
Right.
But I know I'm not going to do that with my kids. Like, I know I want my kids to feel pain. You know? I want them to go through it. I don't want to bring it on them.
Right.
But I my wife and I are pretty intentional about, like, they're gonna climb the mountain. You know, they're gonna climb the mountain. But the only question that I fear, you know, personally, is like, once they start climbing that mountain, am I gonna like redirect? You know, which top of the mountain do they go to? Because my parents never did that with me. My parents never did that with me. My parents were just. They were really, really happy that my sister and I were doing well in school, that we went to college, that we were engaged, and they never, you know, like, they knew, like, I think my dad, like, probably wanted me to, like, go to law school or something, but he never pushed it.
Sure.
He never pushed it.
It seems like an impossible thing to do. Professor McGrath mentioned at the most recent discussion, the one sort of about Israel and Palestine, sort of not about Israel and Palestine, but Professor McGrath said to parents that she was encouraging them to let their children live, right? And let their children make their own decisions. And my mom was there. My mom was there to watch this, and she just reflected on it and was just kind of explaining to me. My mom and I worked together, right? We lived together as well, as well as my dad. And my mom recognized that this is something like she just struggles with, and I know that. But I guess I think it was great for Professor McGrath to say that and for her to hear it, and that was really special. I think what you mentioned about, like, you know, as a father, how do you kind of interfere with your kids but also let them go? I have no insight on that because I'm a kid, but my dad has
I'm sure definitely you have some ideas.
I've definitely learned from my dad, because he's definitely let me make a ton of mistakes, right? But he's also given me a ton of advice. So I think, maybe that's a conversation for you and my dad. You guys could.
I think you can give advice. I think you should. I think you should give advice. You know, but I want to give my kids options, because I think there's the thing that I see the most that my students struggle with in college is that they come here, but they don't know why they're here. And the ones who don't know why they're here, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's really, really hard.
Do you think more students know why? Or more students don't know why they're here?
I think more know why. Yeah. I think more have an idea of what they're doing here and, like, why they want to come to college. But there's definitely a percentage who are just here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just here at Assumption. I don't mean just here.
No,
I mean
in college,
at Holy Cross, at Mass Bay Community College. Like, I've taught at a lot of different schools, a lot of different types of schools.
Bigger state schools. I think this is probably more of a problem.
But can be, cannot be. At bigger state schools or community colleges, you definitely have a percentage of the students who are there just because it's cheap, and they're like, I don't know what to do next, so I'm just going to try to figure it out here. And that's not the worst thing. But then you also have, at state schools and community colleges, older adults, people taking classes in their late 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, who are coming back to school and are very intentional.
Very focused.
Very intentional about why they're there, right? No. I'm getting a post-bac nursing degree so that I can get this new career that I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Like, I'm looking to get an extra certification so I can get a raise at work. You know, like, those people are, like, have a very clear idea of why they're doing what they're doing. You know, so I don't know. I don't know if I would, like, feel comfortable saying, like, it's 60-40 or 70-30. You know, I don't know. I don't know what the number is, but
you're also growing as you go through college, so, like, you'll get more intentional probably as you age.
Probably, yeah. That's. I think that's accurate. But there is something to be said about, and I don't mean intentional about, like, you came to college knowing what you wanted to major in. That's not what I mean.
No,
I mean, you came to college knowing that you wanted to be in college. Like, that there were ideas here that you wanted to sink your teeth into. Right. That's what I mean. I don't mean you came here and you were like, I want to major in accounting, and I, you know, like, Okay, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But I mean, like, you came here knowing that there were going to be a lot of big ideas, mm-hmm. a lot of long readings, you know, a lot of long papers, and that you felt interested. You felt interested in putting your hands into that dirt,
right?
You know, and seeing what was in it. That's all I mean. That's all I mean.
No, sure, and it's hard to do that. I think too, and like to have.
It's hard
because you have to have this idea that there's something valuable that the professor and the school is going to teach you.
Correct.
That you have that you know nothing about.
Correct.
When I was 17 and 16 and 18, I didn't want to admit to knowing nothing about certain things. Mm-hmm. But when I was a freshman, Socrates and the Search for Truth, the first lesson is like, you actually don't know anything, and that's okay. And so that's
None of us know shit.
Yeah.
And the quicker we can figure that out, the better off we'll be.
The more we'll almost know shit, if that like makes sense. Like,
the more you'll know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Which is, it's like a paradox, but it's really cool
mm-hmm.
to begin to learn that. We're talking about college students, so I want to continue that discussion. Right now, a lot of college students struggle with mental health. There's been more awareness brought towards men's mental health as the suicide rates for men are much higher than women after 18.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question for you is, I want to have a big discussion about this.
Sure.
But can you give me some insight on depression and anxiety mm-hmm. just in general?
Yeah, sure.
And how they operate in college students?
So really interesting data on suicide rates too. The suicide attempt rate is actually relatively equal across gender. It's the suicide completion rate that's about 3 to 3.5 times higher for men than women. Okay. And there's a lot of like interesting, you know, potentially confounding factors that play into that. You know, I know I'll talk about depression and anxiety too, but one of those big factors is firearms. Men are more likely to own firearms, and men are more likely to use firearms when they attempt suicide. Whereas women are more likely to they're not called non-lethal suicide attempts. They are lethal suicide attempts, but they're much more like process attempts. But what that means is like the suicide takes a process to occur.
It's not just
and the majority of people who attempt suicide deeply regret it at some point in the process of dying. And then they're able to get medical attention, you know, medical intervention, you know, think of like wrist cutting you know what I'm saying? Or like,
overdosing or maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, for sure. Overdosing would be complicated, like car exhaustion. Does that make sense?
I see.
Things like that. There are a lot of attempts that women are more likely to take those attempts, whereas men are most likely to use a gun. And as a result, there's no process. It's over.
It's one decision.
Yeah. It's over. So, so that's interesting. I wonder about that too. You know what I mean? Like, is suicide more prevalent in men? You know, other things with suicide with men too, though, which I think are salient, are like, I don't think men seek clinical help the way women seek clinical help. I think women are much more. I think women are in general, I know I'm painting with a broad brush here, but like I think in general women are much more attuned to something being off cognitively, emotionally, etc. They're more likely, women, especially adult women, are more likely to have friends than adult men, so they're more likely to talk to people and have people to talk to. Men who are unmarried, like who don't have a spouse or a partner, who do they talk to?
Right.
Who are their friends? You know, who's,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of interesting research. There's a lot of interesting work on this idea, loneliness.
Right.
Right.
And they're loneliness. I think they're two important, separate discussions. Maybe
for sure.
I mean, I'm sure they can kind of combine at certain points, but we should talk about men. We should talk about women and how they're different, right? To address different problems. Is that kind of what you're getting at as well?
Or? Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me about. Sorry to interrupt you.
No worries.
Tell me about. What are the proper terms? Is it psychotherapy? Is that a proper term for?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So counseling, therapy.
So
yeah.
You would argue that that's effective, and why would you argue that?
Yeah, therapy is therapy's relatively effective. Therapy's relatively effective. I don't want to say profoundly effective because that would be, I think that would be like a Pollyannish, you know, description of it. A lot of data shows that the most effective form of treatment is a combination of medication and therapy.
Okay.
But that the most effective therapy is a therapy that involves a client who's motivated, who's properly motivated for treatment. What does that mean? It means that the client has acknowledged that they need help or that they would benefit from help.
Oh, I see.
The client
optimistic
is
maybe.
Well, more honest.
Honest.
Yeah, more. You know, there's a thing called motivational interviewing that you can do in counseling, where you can kind of gauge what level of preparedness this person's at for therapy or for clinical intervention. A client who is motivated and prepared to do therapy, sometimes in like addiction rehabilitation or addiction counseling, this will be called a client who has reached rock bottom, if you've heard that term before, but someone who's like,
sure.
Someone who has hit the bottom and they're like, this has to stop. This has to stop. This road cannot continue. Though for those clients, therapy is wildly effective. For clients who aren't in that place, therapy is moderately to mildly effective. Combinations of medication and therapy tend to be more effective than just medication alone or just psychotherapy alone. Therapy generally works.
Very nice.
Now, the big question is whether it works long term.
Okay.
That's the big question, right?
Not just while you're seeing the therapist.
Does it work short term? Probably.
Seems like it.
Yeah. For a lot of people, there is a real short-term benefit to therapy, regardless of their motivational status, too.
Right?
The big question and, like, the gold standard for follow-up here in, like, clinical trials is 2 years. So, like, once you get 2 years out from therapy, what does the symptom presentation look like for the client? What's the concept look like for the client at that point? And if there's still efficacy 2 years out,
I'm really impressed. I think
pretty good.
philosophy background makes you a very special, intelligent individual, right? Because I think a lot of psychologists might say, "Yeah, it definitely works," and they'd focus on the fact that it works short term. That would be their argument.
Yeah.
And you're sitting here like, "Well, yeah. It probably works. It definitely works short term." Like I'll say that. You might not say
that's probably right. You're probably right. A lot of psychologists, especially like. Yeah, they can be really and again, like I tend to be more critical about this stuff. Like a lot of people in the field tend to be more like yes, it works for everyone. You know, and it's
and
like,
fair enough,
it's
like, right? Because they kind of have to be optimistic as the professionals, right? What I thought of when you were speaking was Viktor Frankl.
Yeah.
And his logotherapy.
Logotherapy.
And I think that there's a huge
meaning therapy.
Meaning therapy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe that's the long-term solution. There's a huge population on social media, and myself kind of included in this. And I have to understand I've never taken antidepressants, so I don't know. I don't have experience with them.
Yeah.
But because of that, I have this kind of outside view, and I look at them, and I have friends who take them, some family members who do as well.
Yeah.
And I just worry that that is just from like a philosophical perspective, like that's maybe just a short-term benefit, right? Or something that, people are making money off these medications. They want you to continue to buy them, right? I can't help but look at it from a business lens as well. And what would you say to the population of people who have these views? And how can we be more understanding and caring to people who take advantage of the medicines?
Yeah, that's a good question. Antidepressants is a complicated topic. Antidepressants really came alive on the scene in the 1980s, 1970s, 80s, but then they really took hold in the 90s. It was the 90s that was like the era of like Prozac. You know what I'm saying?
The Sopranos like, and they.
Yeah, yeah. It was 90s.
Comes out early, yeah.
Yeah, it was that decade that really became like the era for it, and there were some really profound efficacy data sets that came out of that decade of time, in the 90s, where people, These drugs were being marketed as cure-alls for mental illness.
Okay.
They were unequivocally being marketed as silver bullets for and not just for depression, for anxiety, right? For eating disorders. They were being marketed as a cure-all for a myriad of mental illnesses. 20 years later, 30 years later, have those data sets held up? I think the answer is resoundingly no. These are not cure-alls. They are not silver bullets. They do not eliminate depression. They do not eliminate anxiety. We actually don't even know biochemically how they work, like what the what the mechanism is behind them. They don't produce serotonin or norepinephrine. They hold more of it in the synaptic cleft for a longer period of time. And the final thing I'll say, not the final thing, but the final point I'll make against them, and then I'll make an argument for them,
sure,
is that in most clinical trials, the placebo is 60 to 85% as effective as the medication, which means that people who took a sugar pill experience pretty significant efficacy relative to people who took the antidepressant. So that's my argument against them. My argument against them is they're not cure-alls, they're not fix-alls, they're not silver bullets, and they probably overstated their stay. Now, are they effective for people? Yeah, they are. Specifically for giving people energy, for giving people a level of cognitive, emotional, and physical energy when they are severely depressed. Most people who are experiencing severe depression do not have the energy to exercise, to go to therapy, to
do those things
out to dinner with their partner, to make love to their partner. Do you know what I'm saying? Like the things that give most human beings a basic level of joy or a basic level of peace, when you are experiencing severe depression, your ability to even complete those tasks is almost impossible.
It's almost impossible.
So the idea behind the antidepressant was to try to get certain neurotransmitters, serotonin, norepinephrine, maybe dopamine in some cases, more activated in the nervous system so that that individual now has a baseline of physical, cognitive, and emotional energy to go do things that can make them happy. And they seem to be able to do that. They seem to be able to do that. The question is, and this is always going to be the question that I would have, this would always be like the question I had, like for like the pharmaceutical side of it, like the pro antidepressant or pro pharmaceutical approach to it would be, you know, what is the long term? Is the long term approach that the individual, like that this is just a permanent chemical imbalance in the individual, and the individual now has to stay permanently on the medication or some different variation of the cocktail, you know, for the remainder of their life, right?
Right.
Or is it that the chemical imbalance is now more balanced and now the individual can try to find some form of psychotherapeutic or holistic form of balance in their life that provides stability?
Right.
You brought up pharma, so I'll go down there too.
Sure, please.
I think there's no question that anytime pharmaceutical companies are pushing something, they're not pushing something for short-term usage.
Right.
You know, it's not in the...
That would be a good investment.
It's not in the financial interest of pharmaceutical companies to have short-term customers. So that is another, you know, kind of... And I hope that doesn't sound conspiratorial,
I kind of brought that
Yeah,
up.
It's another concern that I have. Concern. I mean, if you look at lobbying money in Washington right now, one of the number one lobbies against cannabis or psychedelic legalization are pharmaceutical companies.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Because pharmaceutical companies want you taking painkillers, not marijuana.
Not marijuana.
Because marijuana is not biochemically addictive.
Hmm.
And opioids.
So can we talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, because, sure.
So as far as marijuana can give people that energy, that boost, right, to do things, say they're depressed.
Yeah, yeah.
Possibly. Okay.
Marijuana does a lot of things.
Sure. But that aside, you said it isn't biochemically addictive.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I don't know the biochemistry behind marijuana and then painkillers. Could you explain that to me? Because I have the view that marijuana is addictive based on experience, friends' experiences, and et cetera. Yeah.
Marijuana or any psychedelic or hallucinogen drug, mushrooms, psilocybin, ecstasy, MDMA, LSD, they can all be psychologically addictive. No question about it. In the same way that gambling, shopping, online video gaming, social media, these are all what the DSM-5 has referred to as behavioral or process addictions. The DSM-5 even added gambling as a form of addiction, as a clinical form of addiction. Is gambling, is DraftKings biologically, biochemically addictive? No, it doesn't change your biochemistry to go on a gambling app, but it can produce a high level of dopamine in your body.
Yeah.
And even just the process of logging into the gambling app is like, you know, super exciting. And that's what people can get addicted to. So no doubt, marijuana usage, psilocybin usage, gambling behavior, these are all addictive behaviors. But these drugs, psilocybin, marijuana, LSD, these drugs are not biochemically addictive. They have they do not build, you will not go through withdrawal if you have used these drugs for months or years of your life, in the way you will have to go through detox and withdrawal if you've drank alcohol or, you know, become addicted to opioids or meth.
Nicotine, right, as well.
Nicotine, right? Okay. Caffeine.
Caffeine.
I always, whenever I teach drugs with my students, I say, how many of you, if you were to stop drinking coffee today, how many of you would immediately start having migraines and become nauseous? And, you know, like a third of them will raise their hands. Sure. And I'm like,
that's withdrawals.
So you're what?
Yeah, right.
You're going through withdrawal, right? You're going through withdrawal. Now, there's no doubt if I use cannabis products every day for the next 3 years because I have social anxiety, which I think a lot of people use cannabis for things like social anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. They get nervous. And cannabis, like you said, it can lower anxiety. It can lower anxiety. And now all of a sudden I decide to quit cannabis products and I go to class. Can I start getting paranoid? Can I start getting really nervous?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. But that's not me laying on my bed, sweating, puking into a bucket and feeling like there's bugs crawling on my skin. No. That's the result of heroin, alcohol, meth, and even caffeine to high levels.
And do you know what happens in the body with those biochemically addictive?
So I'm not a scientist, so I don't want to like totally outkick my coverage here. Okay. But generally speaking, marijuana and hallucinogenic drugs, what they do is they use neurotransmitter sets and systems that are already built into your nervous system. So like there are these serotonin repository areas on your spinal cord and in your brain, on your cerebral cortex, and they're literally just waiting to be dial the code and they'll pop open. And that's what all of these drugs do in a different way. Like LSD attaches to people's spinal cords and it opens up the serotonin, like the 5-HT2A serotonin receptor areas on their spinal cord, and just all of a sudden, like there's all this serotonin, but it's already in your body. Does that make sense? Like that, serotonin's already in your body. It's just waiting to be unlocked. Marijuana, I think marijuana, it finds dopamine receptors. So there's these cannabinoid receptor areas that are all around, in your brain and all throughout your tummy and your nervous system. And marijuana finds those cannabinoid receptor areas. And it's the same thing. It just kind of like punches the code in and, you know, these pre-programmed pockets of dopamine and serotonin just kind of move throughout the body. Now, let me be really clear. I have no idea why that makes you trip. I have no idea. I have no idea, you know, I mean, because like people who take antidepressants are also increasing serotonin levels to some extent, but they're not tripping.
Right.
Well, like, taking antidepressants is not the same as taking LSD or mushrooms. Like, these certainly, are totally different experiences. So why does serotonin do something that's so unique here and something that's so unique over there? You know, it's a question I'd like to ask the God that created this universe one day if I ever get the chance to.
maybe the closest thing, we got Andrew Huberman, so we'll check out his, because he's had some podcast series on LSD.
Yeah.
So we actually talked about him in the summer.
Yeah.
And so you're familiar with some of his work that he does or podcasts?
A little bit. Okay. A little bit. Yeah. I think he's a neuroscientist.
He's
right?
a neuroscientist and from Stanford.
Yeah.
He's really blown up on social media.
Yeah. Like,
everyone seems to know him now.
Yeah, I've seen
people
that.
Cite his work. I've cited his work recently. And
really into health and
certainly really into health. And he has like a 3-hour episode on how the THC binds to your, and I think it's called the endogenous cannabinoid system. And he says that like, it's very interesting how he goes about his episodes, especially this one about marijuana, because he makes it clear he's not trying to demonize marijuana. Mm-hmm. He's trying to genuinely provide all the facts that he has come to study and understand.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of the episode, turns out that it is a more dangerous drug than people come to understand, and I think he does a great job at laying out kind of how it works. And
what was his argument for the dangers?
Well, he thinks that it messes up this endogenous cannabinoid. That might not be the right word, but it messes
it
up
like
the system.
Disrupts the cannabinoid system. Yeah, that's
because he says that this system is unpredictable normally. Mm. It's normally unpredictable. And that's why sometimes you have good moods, sometimes you have bad moods. It's kind of how he would simplify the language to someone like me.
Yeah.
But what he made clear was that when you ingest marijuana, THC in any form, something happens in your brain where it binds to this system with an affinity that is much more than the natural occurrence of this reaction in your brain.
So that's true, and that's the same with LSD and psilocybin.
Okay.
They bind to those 5-HT2A receptor areas in a way that's even stronger than natural serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm kind of generally familiar with that set of science that he's talking about. For me, that didn't make them dangerous. For me, that gave it more evidence that there was like some God that created these things.
That
was like, this stuff works in your body, you mm-hmm. know, so you should, you know.
And he advances over to he thinks it's very dangerous for pregnancy,
I'm sure it is. I'm sure there are some pitfalls with.
Right. One more thing was, I think this totally goes over my head, but I think he was talking about, maybe it's called gray matter in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So he was talking about how it disrupts that. And then he was referencing that it's not dangerous for everyone necessarily from this like psychological perspective, but for people that have history of certain like mental illnesses, that they could be more susceptible from mental neurosis.
So I think that's definitely true. I think that especially with psychosis or schizophrenia, listen, if I'm going to sit here and tell you that antidepressants are not a silver bullet, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that something else is a silver bullet.
Yeah.
My general position is skepticism. I'm a skeptic. Show it to me. Prove it to me. That's my general position as a psychologist.
And a philosopher.
Show me that what you're saying is true, right? Mm-hmm. Show me that what you're saying is true. I think that, you know, I think that we have to be careful about that. Now, with that being said, these drugs were all legal for a really, really long time in America.
Which drugs?
Marijuana, and then psilocybin, LSD, mushrooms. So marijuana was totally legal up through the 1950s in America. No federal legislation on it. Yeah.
Okay.
And then LSD and psilocybin were legal in America. Legal, like recreationally legal. You can use them wherever. Up until the early 70s, up until the Nixon administration. So people through the 50s and 60s. So, I know. This is wild stuff, right?
I did not know this.
This is wild stuff.
And then was Nixon like the war on drugs? Is that kind of
the war on drugs? The war on drugs, right? Yeah. So, you know, the counterculture, Woodstock, hippies, Timothy Leary groups, those were not Nixon voters. Right? You know, people who attended Woodstock were not, you know, voting for Richard Nixon, right? Yeah. Nixon in I think it was 1970 or 71, he called Tim Leary at Harvard, and Tim Leary is his own problem. I'm not a fan of Tim Leary myself, but Richard Nixon called him the most dangerous human being in America. Oh my God. Right. I mean, Tim Leary was a narcissist, and Tim Leary was a cultish figure.
Okay.
But he was not the most dangerous person in America in the 1970s. Yeah. Right. I mean, he didn't kill anybody. He didn't rape anybody. Like he was a cult of personality. Right. That's what Tim Leary was. And he went too far. He went too far with the movement. But through the 60s, right, through the 50s and 60s and early 70s, clinical research was being conducted, clinical psychotherapeutic research was being conducted with these substances. And the efficacy rates for things like reduction in alcoholism, reduction in depression, reduction in anxiety were overwhelming.
Wow.
Overwhelmingly positive.
Wow.
The last legal LSD dosage was given in 1974 at Spring Grove Hospital for an alcoholism study. And then there was roughly 30 years of no research on psychedelics.
Because of the laws.
From the 70s to the early 2000s. Wow. Johns Hopkins University in the 2000s, so about 20 years ago now, started very low-key, a psilocybin research lab. So this was Roland Griffiths, who was actually a behavioral psychologist at Johns Hopkins, which is like really interesting because behaviorism is like, you know, the opposite of this. You know, behaviorism is like, we're all animals. You know what I mean? You just need to train people. And this is, you know, yeah, Griffiths is an interesting dude. He started doing transcendental meditation in his 50s, and he started having these like really profound spiritual experiences. And it led him to want to study like psilocybin and psychedelics. So he opened up a psychedelic research lab at Johns Hopkins in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, and started running very low-key psilocybin research trials. He's been doing it for 20 years now.
Wow.
And now, today, Harvard's running a psilocybin trial on depression right now. NYU's running ecstasy MDMA trials for post-traumatic stress disorder. Johns Hopkins is continuing their psilocybin trials. I mean, you know, Walter Reed, which is the major military hospital, like the major VA military hospital in America, is running an MDMA trial for post-traumatic stress right now. So we now have the start of the clinical research again.
It seems to be successful as far as I've read.
So far?
Yeah.
So far. But again, I'm in a place where, show me your data.
Okay.
Cool. Show me the data. So far, the data's been really solid.
Right.
But again, a lot of substances and a lot of therapies, they have their heyday. You know what I'm saying? And they have like almost like the momentum of placebo effect behind them, which is like people start to really get on the train of this is going to be effective, this is going to be effective. And then people start to believe that it is effective. And then guess what? It's effective.
Yeah.
And then like 10 years later, 15 years later, it's less effective.
Right.
So, you know, I want to see a decade. Show me a decade. You know, let's look at a decade of data on this. And then we can talk about like real – let's look at two-year follow-ups. Does that make sense? Let's not just look at 100%. Like, okay, someone did 3 grams of mushrooms. They had a really profound trip. Their depression levels were lowered. Where are they at in 2 years?
Right.
Does the depression just come back 2 months later? Like, you know, we got to look at all that. We got to look at all that. So
you mentioned belief, and the first thing – that came to my mind was faith, and when people have faith, it seems to not just be good, but it seems to like practically work.
Yeah, it does.
Andrew Huberman, or was this Huberman? This was a Harvard study. I didn't get this from Huberman. I just read this.
Yeah, I think I know the study you're talking about.
Two different groups.
Yeah.
10-week trial.
Religious affiliations.
No, different study. I just think it kind of reflects this religious idea, but two different groups, 10 weeks. Group A wrote once a week for 15 minutes positive things that they hope to accomplish, things that they will accomplish.
Yeah.
Group B wrote about once a week, 15 minutes, things that bother them every day.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the 10 weeks, Group B, no improvements. Group A, they started going to the gym more. They had less visits to the doctors. They felt better. They felt optimistic. And
I think that that's valuable. I think they're both valuable. Okay. I get a little skeptical of the... It can be a little bit of an ethos of cognitive behavioral therapy sometime or cognitive therapy sometime that it's like it's all about positivity. It's all about optimism. Yeah. It's all about reappraising your perceptions so you can see the better side of things. I think with probably 90 or 88% of life, being more positive, being more grateful, looking at the sunny side of things is super helpful. Okay. But I think that there's a percentage of life, and I would call this like the existential core of being human. That's just not pleasant. It's just not pleasant. And there's, and you don't have to make it be pleasant. And you don't have to make it be pleasant. Okay. Freud called it the unconscious. You know, Frankl probably called it something like, the dark night of the soul. You know, or some, you know what I mean? Yeah, you know, some, I know I'm stealing that from someone else. So I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. But like, you know what I mean? Like I think that was like St. John of the Cross was like the dark night of the soul, right? You know, Freud believed that a part of our mind was literally dark, literally dark. Hmm. And there's nothing we can or should do about it except acknowledge it. Acknowledge it. Come to terms with it. So I generally, I am pro spirituality, not just because it makes people positive. It does. It does make people more positive. It makes them more optimistic. It gives them something to look forward to. But I also think that spirituality and like faith, they help people understand darkness as well. Oh, right. And not change it. Do you know what I'm saying? And not change it. Like they help people, like a lot of religions do a good job at just describing like there's bad shit in the world.
Right.
And it's not going anywhere. And like you should be politically active against it. You should try to fight it. You should try to stop it. But there is a part of being human that is probably perhaps unsolvable.
Mm. And many would say, like, why would God make a world that has where that exists?
Well, that's the Brothers Karamazov, man. That's the Grand Inquisitor. You know, that's Ivan. You know, Ivan and the Brothers Karamazov.
Not familiar at all.
Yeah, no worries. So it's like the famous chapter of the book where Ivan goes through all these stories of children getting murdered in these heinous ways, right? And like Dostoevsky, the real Dostoevsky, like the person, he would go throughout his life and keep like press clippings that he would find in the newspaper of like horrible crime stories, like you know parents who had abused their children, you know what I'm saying? Just like the most vicious stuff you'll ever see, right? Dostoevsky kept like a journal of these clippings because he was just fascinated.
I mean,
he was fascinated with the suffering, and for Dostoevsky that led to the question like, can there be a God? Can God exist if this level of evil exists, right? Can God? I mean, you know, my wife works in the Worcester Public School System, right? So there are things that she sees on a day-to-day basis that would shock us to the core, right? Children who are neglected and abandoned by their parents.
How do you make sense of
that? How does that happen? How does that happen? Children who are sexually abused by their stepfathers. How does that occur?
Right.
So the Brothers Karamazov, the question is, how could God exist if this stuff occurs? Freedom is not worth the price of suffering. Like freedom is not worth the price of suffering.
Wouldn't that's it, the exchange?
Wouldn't right? have been, would it, you know? Wouldn't it have been a better system to have no free will?
No free will. Yeah.
So then all of this stuff couldn't exist. Now Dostoevsky ultimately comes on the side of no. Right. Freedom is good. It's not good.
I'm happy he has that argument.
It's the condition. It's the condition. Freedom is our condition. It's our condition. And we can turn it into beauty and love and joy, or we can turn it into child abuse.
Right.
You know, like all of that stuff exists in reality. Right now in the world, there's like two things are happening right now in the world. There's a child being abused right now somewhere in Worcester, and there's a a family giving birth to a baby who's weeping over the joy that this baby's bringing into their lives. Like, but like both of those things are happening right now. Without free will, neither can happen, right? Without free will, neither can happen, but both are happening. And whatever God created the conditions of this system said, I want both. Right. Or I'm going to allow for both.
And I think that's where faith in God comes into play. It's like, I'm going to have faith that he had this intentional, purposeful, good design. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Or just that. Yeah. That this is worth it. You know, that I think you're right. That this is intentional. Mm. This is intentional. And so I think you're right. To get back to it, I think religion and spirituality help us to be more positive, more optimistic, more resilient, more like faith in a better day. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Something good can come of this. But for me, spirituality also helps me understand darkness and accept it. And not just like accept it and say like, you know, but like understand it, process it. Hmm. You know, because it's not going anywhere.
It is true.
It is true. It is like metaphysically true that the light and the dark both exist.
Right.
You know, and we're tied to both. You know, we're tied to both of them. You know.
I think now I'm better understanding this clip I saw of Jordan Peterson where he said like, I'm staring into the abyss, staring into the dark, in hopes to find light in that somehow, some way.
Yeah.
I think what you just explained sheds light on that.
Well, and you know, experience. You asked the question earlier too about mental illness.
Yeah.
And I think people who've went through severe anxiety or severe depression, I think that they've tasted that. You know, I think that they've tasted that.
There is
a level of this life, there is a side of this life that is beautiful and almost overwhelming to the point that if you looked at it too long, you would just start weeping, right? That's how beautiful it is. Yeah. And then on the other side, there is the nothing. There is this abyss that you know, that people are, whatever, fortunately or unfortunately, again, like, it's part of free will. Does that make sense? It's part of, like, the whole cosmic system. People will inevitably touch that side of it as well. You know, I think that's what depression feels like for a lot of people. Hopelessness, isolation, nothingness, right? Existential dread, as Viktor Frankl would say, existential dread.
Yeah.
Meaninglessness. As Frankl would say, you know, I don't know what I'm doing here. There's nothing more horrible. There's nothing better than feeling like you have a reason to be here. And there's nothing worse than feeling like you have no reason to be here. You know what I mean? Like they, you know, but I think that a spiritual dimension to psychotherapy or a spiritual dimension to psychology, it helps us see the fullness of the picture. I think it helps people see the fullness of the picture.
Right. What do you think about... Do you think it's necessary to get into darkness?
Probably.
I was thinking probably, too.
Probably.
I was thinking yes. Like it is.
I don't know. I don't know if it's... I don't know if it's like... I don't know if like you have to. I don't know if like you have to, like I really hope my kids don't have to go through it, and like I, you know what I'm saying, like I
hear what you're saying from a father's perspective.
Yeah, like I, you know, I don't know. Probably. I think if you
to a certain degree, like it's inevitable. Like,
I think to a certain degree, if you're gonna drink from the cup of joy and beauty, you're gonna drink from the cup of dread and suffering. You know what I mean? I think that they probably go together.
Yes.
And if you're going to have profound, profound, beautiful and positive experiences in life, you're probably going to, your mind is just probably capable of feeling the other side of that coin as well, you know, to some extent.
Right.
But I guess I don't know if it has to get to the point where it's like clinical depression, you know, for everybody. Does that make sense?
Like, that makes sense. I think,
you know, and Frankl was actually interested in this too, of like, less classification of these phenomena, right, and more just like these are the ebbs and flows of life. You know, Frankl in Man's Search for Truth refers to them as weather patterns. Right. It's like in order for there to be sun and like nice, clear, not humid days, you have to have, you know, you have to have rain and you have to have cold. You know, like Frankl refers to the mind as just weather. And he's like, we need to be less inclined to clinically assess this stuff.
That's so cool that he does that.
Yeah, and more inclined to just understand that the ebbs and flows do occur and they will occur. Now, that doesn't mean that some people don't go through clinical, like, I'm not denying clinical depression is a real thing. It is a real thing.
Right.
I guess I'm just saying, I don't know if you have to go through clinical depression to experience like the great joy of life. I think you can feel deep sadness without it getting to the point where you're clinically depressed. But I don't know. Maybe I'm just parsing terms.
No, I think you're right. I think what I was thinking about when I made that point was that like it takes a degree of suffering to be able to deal with your next bout of suffering better, I think.
Yeah, that's probably something true.
And I think that, I mean, I'm sure there's been times in your life where I'm sure now when you face adversity and challenge, you do it in a better way than you did when you were 20 or 25.
I don't know. I think for the most part, yeah.
Okay.
But not always. Not always. I think for the most part, yeah. I think you're right. I think in general, you're correct. You know, when you're going through this when you're young, it feels like the ship is really bouncing across the ocean and there's no safe harbor.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say in general, I've gotten better at understanding, like, the storm ends. Like, the storm ends. Just ride it out. But, man, like, sometimes when the boat's shaking, and honestly, you know, the hard thing about dealing with it when you're older is, like, when you're younger, you probably, like, in college, like, you probably have more people around you. Right. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And like,
it's, like, more acceptable.
Yeah. And, like, sometimes when you get older and you like have a family, like you have your family, but you kind of like, you know, you're not always around people and friends, you know what I mean? As much as you were when you're younger too, you know? Mm. You know, I remember, you know, being in like grad school and being able to like talk to people in grad school about like, oh man, this is hard, you know, stuff like that. But like, you know, and now I have my wife, you know, my wife and I will talk about it, but I mean like, you know, you only gonna talk to one person about it, you know, for 50 years. You know what I mean? Like, it's a hard conversation to keep going all the time. And sometimes you don't want to burden them with,
of course,
you know, with it all the time. But yeah, I think generally you're right. I think generally the older you get, I mean, a part of it too is just your brain gets bigger when you get older. So your brain grows in volume and white matter synaptic connection, like until you're like 27. So like, yeah, when you're 19, like your prefrontal cortex is not fully wired yet. So trying to understand things like this will end or this has an ending or this is where I was before or like planning judgment, you know, like those skills which are coming from this part of your brain,
still developing.
They're not fully online. When you're a young adult or a teenager, when you get to your mid to late 20s, they are fully online.
It's like good to know. I'm happy about
that. Yeah. And so, you know, there are things that help me now. I'm much more organized now as an adult than I was when I was in college.
Okay.
Being organized helps. I'm much more disciplined now as an adult than I was when I was in college. And for me, the way I kind of like stave off the torrent of the storm is through like consistency. Like I try to exercise relatively regularly. I try to have a relatively normal diet. I try to sleep 7 hours a night. You know what I'm saying? Like I try to keep like a pretty basic, simple, consistent routine. And that offers predictability, and predictability is kind of what I need when the unpredictability when the unpredictability hits.
Seems like those are the things that combat depression, combat anxiety.
For me.
Well, I guess. I said that because for me too, when I have a routine, my life is much better than when I don't. And when I have a routine, I make better decisions too.
I do too.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, I do too.
So yeah, I'm really working on. And, you know, there are times when, like, over Christmas break, I probably won't have as good of a routine. But hopefully, when the spring starts, I can really lock in my routine, and I can take what worked from prior semesters and put away what didn't work.
So I think people, like, when I was deployed with my unit, I think some people in my unit, like, almost thought it was funny because I'm just, like, so, it was so hard to be deployed and, like, be away from my family that, like, I just kept, I would wake up every morning, I would go for a run, like, then I would go eat breakfast, and then we would do our classes, and then I'd go back to my computer, get my stuff done, and then I'd go to the gym, and then I'd go, and then we play board games, and it was, like, I just tried to live, like, the same day, like, over and over again, because that just, that, grounded like, you? That grounded me, because, like, you know, I was 7,000, 8,000 miles away from my family. We were in kind of a, you know.
You got to tell me about this. I don't know. I forgot. I meant to ask a question about this, and now
no worries.
I forgot that you were in the service. So tell me what that experience was, like.
I've been in the Army Reserve since 2013.
Okay.
I joined when I was 27 years old, so a little bit later than most people join. I would say that I probably joined out of something that you were describing earlier, like an existential crisis. I played team sports my whole life. I loved team sports. Loved them. Loved being a member of a team. I was never a great player. I was never a great athlete. But I knew how to, like, do something. You know, like, I knew how to, like, do a job and execute it. Oh, you know what I'm saying? And
that's
loved.
Great. That's wonderful.
Yeah. And I loved that feeling. And then in my mid-20s, man, I was just like, what the fuck am I doing? You know what I mean? Like, I was literally
missing that.
Yeah. I don't know. I was going through like a real existential crisis.
Right.
I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know where I was going. I was having panic attacks. Like, it was really, really scary stuff. And I was like, and I wanted to join the military out of high school, but it was the one thing that my parents were like, no, don't do that. Like, it was the only thing that they were like, that they like pushed me away from. And I'm not, like, upset that they did. Whatever.
Course,
you know what I mean? Like,
Thank God they did.
I don't know. Who knows? But then I was like, nah. I was like, I got to join. I just got to do it. It was something that I always wanted to do. I was 16 years old when 9/11 happened. You know, a lot of my friends went and served right after high school. You know, like, I got to go. I just got to go do this. I got to do it. So I joined the reserves so that I could stay in school. Do you know what I'm saying? And keep doing stuff.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, I just fucking loved it. Like, I loved going through basic training. I loved going through OCS. Like, even when they were like grinding us up, you know, and doing all that stuff, I was just super, super into it. Like, I was super into the grind and like the solidarity part of it. You know, I was always the person who was like, I loved cheering people, you know, I'm like getting people go, like, sure. You know, people were complaining like, no, let's go.
It was so good.
So I've just been in, you know, I've been in the reserves. And then, like, the longer you stay in, you know, you're going to, like, something's going to happen, you know, at some point. So I was in the 947th Forward Surgical Team out of West Hartford, Connecticut. And, yeah, back in 2020, like, late 2020, we got our Warno, you know, that was like, hey, you guys are going out the door in 2022. And then we basically spent all of 2021, like, working up to it, like, doing a bunch of work to lead up to it. And then, we had this great deployment, man. It was awesome. Like, we were attached to Naval Special Warfare. So we were Army, but we got attached to, like, SEAL teams. And we were their medical asset. So,
super cool.
Yeah. Like, it couldn't have been better. And SEAL teams are, like, the best coworkers you'll ever have in your life. They, you know, you come on ground, and they put you through the ringer for, like, the first 2 weeks. Like, they evaluate you. And they're like, are you competent or are you not competent? And if you're not competent, you're going to sit in the corner. And if you are competent, you're good. Like, so for the first two weeks, they were like, we were teaching medical classes. We were running scenarios with them. And then they had these big events, like these big medical events that they would, like, simulate for us and, like, put my team through it to see if we could, like, competently do this. You know, and by the end of 10 days or 2 weeks of doing this, they were like, yeah, you guys are good. And then they just, like...
So what was your role? I'm sorry.
Yeah. So I was the medical field officer. So my job was, like, I had... So our team was 20 people, but when we got to Somalia, 10 of us went here and 10 of us went there. So we went in different places.
With different SEALs or?
Yeah, with different SEAL teams. Yeah, yeah. So it was all SEAL team. It was all the same SEAL team, but like the SEAL teams have different platoons. So like one platoon goes over here, one platoon goes there, one team goes there, one team goes there. So we were with the same guys the whole time. They were with the same guys the whole time, but we never saw each other. Like never did the roads cross.
Okay.
Yeah. So we were over there and we were in central Somalia. So we were in the middle of nowhere. But a lot of the operations were going on like out of where we were, so it was really exciting. Like probably like two or three nights a week, like the partner forces were like they were loading up and going out at night, and they had all these like terrorist targets, like Al Qaeda terrorist targets that they were hunting down, and then we were just on call in case one of them got shot or blown up or hurt or anything.
Okay.
And so we were there for like all of 2022. We crossed over with two different SEAL teams because our deployment was 9 months, but theirs are 6 months. So we had like 6 months with one and then 3 months with another at the end of it.
Okay.
But even that was like totally fine because we had a really good reputation with the first one. So once the second one came in, they were like, yeah, you guys like, you guys are good. So my job was to basically My job was basically operations, logistics, and management. So I had I had two surgeons, an anesthesiologist or a CRNA. I had two nurses, two medics, an OR tech. You know, I had nine people working on my team, and I was in charge of that team. But my job was to make sure that we had all the that our medical equipment was good to go, that we had enough Class 8 supply for, you know, enough Class 8 medical supply. That when the SEAL teams would meet to plan operations, I had to go sit with like in those meetings, and they would say like what the op is, and then I would be like, all right, this is what we can do, this is what we can't do. You know what I mean? And kind of give them our left and right limits.
Oh, really cool.
Yeah.
Wait, so like, why did they accept you for that? I mean, were you at this time you weren't 20? Now you're much.
It's a good question. When
you're much older, but like, did you have certain accreditations in the medical field or?
No. When you branch officer in the military, like when you go through OCS or you branch, you pick like different fields that you want to go into. A lot of people want to go to like infantry, or now a big one is like intelligence. Those are big fields. But you know, I was 27 when I joined. I was like almost done with a PhD, you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I should probably like go medical because I think that's where I would like.
Yeah.
I think that's just what I would know the most and have the most efficacy.
But you don't need a doctorate.
No. People with bachelor's degrees in management, you know, were doing the same job that I was doing. Yeah, I chose medical, and then got picked for it because I was like, I think I would do the most good.
Right.
And, like, I don't think
that seems.
I don't think I'd be a very good infantry officer. You know? I think I'd be better in medical.
I mean, that seemed like something that was. I mean, to Viktor Frankl's credit, like that was something that was meaningful.
It was
needed meaning. And you found it there.
It was deeply meaningful. The deployment was deeply, deeply meaningful. The men and women that I deployed with are still to this day some of the most cherished and meaningful people that I've ever met in my life. And I will love them as long as I live.
Wow.
And as a reservist, it's hard because then you kind of all scatter. You know what I'm saying? After it's over. And I miss them. You know, we keep in touch. We text. You know, we have a group chat, you know what I'm saying, and we keep in touch. I wish I made more time to see them more often.
Okay.
You know, but life happens, you know what I'm saying?
And, of course, yeah.
And you get busy and stuff. But, yeah, I mean, those are some of the best friends and people that I've ever had in my life, that I ever will have in my life. And
probably moments like the meetings and just.
And I would do anything for them, and I believe that they would do anything for me. So,
wow.
Yeah, but I mean, like, we had big moments together, like, we had big, like, crazy moments together, but then we also just played a lot of Catan,
hung out,
we just, like, hung out and, like, made fun of each other and, like, you know,
just like what dudes would do, friends would do.
Yeah, we just got super, you know, super silly and close,
yeah,
you know what I mean,
awesome.
When we were over there,
that's
so,
wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great experience.
Make me want to join the reserves. My mom's gonna hate you.
It was for me. It's not for everybody. And and honestly, I got really lucky getting that deployment. Some deployments aren't as exciting and as interesting as the one that we got really lucky. I mean, we got really lucky. But yeah, you know, it was something that I wanted to do. It was something that I'm proud to have done, and you know, I think service feels good. You know, mm-hmm. I think service feels good, even if you're not always clear about what it means. You know, we were in Somalia. I was like,
we'll be done.
Yeah, like we're not really protecting America over here, but we were definitely helping Somalians. That's for sure.
Right.
Like the Somalian military, the Somalian government. You know, they've been at war with terrorists for 30 years, so that felt good.
Right.
You know, that felt good.
Yeah, helping any human.
Like, yeah, helping any human. Helping any human felt good. We would on Sundays we would play soccer. Because we all live together on the same. Awesome. We all live together at the same airbase. So like we would drive down to their compound, and we would all play like pickup soccer. And it was like the Somalians versus the Americans.
That's so cool.
That must have
fired you up.
Well, it was just awesome. I'm terrible at soccer, so okay, it wasn't great. But like it was just awesome to do. And like
let's get some pads out.
The first time we played, they beat us, and they were like, you know. Like embracing each other, oh, okay, crying, yeah, you know, yeah. they were over the moon. You know what I mean? They were over the moon, and it was like such a sweet moment.
That's great.
I was so happy for them. Like it was such a sweet moment. You know, like it was great. It was great being out there, but.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, we're coming over, I think, an hour and 10 minutes here. I'm going to ask one final question.
Oh, yeah.
Flying by. What's your advice to young men?
I've got two sons. I've got a daughter. My advice is probably not different to my daughter than it is to my sons, if I'm being honest.
Okay.
Maybe the one thing I would say to my sons that's a little bit differently than I would say to my daughter is really, really focus on communicating what you feel. I think women and girls do a much better job at talking.
I think so too.
Than boys and men do. I don't know if that's biological or cultural or cognitive. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know why that is. But like trying to get them to communicate better and more honestly and effectively would be something that I would want to focus on with them. But outside of that, you know, I want the same thing for my sons that I do for my daughter. I want them to live a meaningful life. I want them to find work that has deep personal value to them. I want them to really be honest about the relationships that they're committing themselves to. I want them to commit intimately to people who are their friends, and will be their friends. But I wouldn't say anything different to my boys, you know what I mean, than I would to my daughter about any of that stuff.
You're a man, and I'll probably ask Professor Coleman what her advice is to women. But
yeah. I would say for boys and for men, I think the only caveat that I would have, whether it's my students or my sons or whoever, would be talk. Okay. Like talk.
Yeah.
And get engaged. Get engaged. Like, male young men are so less engaged than young women are. Like so many more. I think like so many more young women are so much more focused and you know what I mean. Like they, sure. And maybe that's just a maturity thing. Like male brains do develop a little bit later than female brains. That's a part of it. But like find something
you love. Yeah.
Yeah, find something. Get into it and just make sure when the boat starts rocking. Talk to people who love you, because people are here for you. Talk to them. I think girls do a better job, like having friends, communicating with friends. You know what I'm saying?
Right. No, I think they do. Yeah. But I think that's wonderful advice.
Yeah, thanks. So
thank you, Professor Seneca. We'll call it here.
Yeah.
This was an awesome conversation, man.
Thanks for what you're doing.
I appreciate it. I'm going to keep working hard interviewing all different people, all different disciplines, all different expertise, and students as well. And just hopefully create something special here. So.
Yeah, we're doing good stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, take care of yourself, bud.
Let's go. That was awesome. I thought my cousin is...
I lost track of time there.
Yeah,
Sorry,
don't apologize. It was awesome. I could have gone for another 50 minutes.
Yeah, I know.
My cousin Connor, he went to ROTC, Virginia Tech.
Oh, cool.
Now he's like jumping out of helicopters and stuff all the time. And he's,
yeah.
I think he's a sergeant now, which is
great. That's great. Yeah, I mean, that's some good stuff. I mean, everybody,